Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 118. And they call it Democracy. The show is from a song by Bruce Colburn, Call It Democracy, and that's riffing off the feature book Democracy Incorporated, Managed Democracy and the Specter of Inverted Totalitarianism by Sheldon S. Wolin, published by Princeton University, published 2008. It's about a 290-page book with heavily footnoted, lots of references, and just chock full of interesting phrases, ideas, summaries, a bit of history, and quite an assessment of the current times, and helping to give a sense of where things are going. This is your host, Monk. Thank you for listening. Happy 2015 to all the listeners. This is the first show of the year. Just a few notes. Some shows that are in still doing parts. The Genocide of the Mind, the Native American personal stories. That is, I think there's one more show to do on that one. And Pepe Escobar's Globalist Stand, which has potential for a whole bunch more parts. But I'm mentioning that in lieu of this book, another book that's probably going to take a bunch of parts, and one that I just finished reading, so I'm excited to get to, because there's so much in the book that doing these shows is a helpful review to me as well. Sheldon Wolin's Democracy Incorporated, Managed Democracy and the Specter of Inverted Totalitarianism, published by Princeton University. And What I did while reading this was to, along with my typical notes, highlighted bits and page numbers, was to anytime you made a reference to inverted totalitarianism or managed democracy, I made some specific categories. So that is basically going to be this part one of this show to give the overview of what that means, because these are phrases that really, without knowing that, it's that's the thesis of the book. And as the title suggests, Democracy Incorporated, to my understanding, that's another way of saying fascism by Mussolini's definition of the merger of corporate and state powers. So ideally, democracy is state helping the people. Incorporated is ideally a corporation making a profit, helping the people, serving the customer, not making toxic waste and ruining the earth. But when those two, not only, but when those two combine, it's the proverbial fox guarding the hen house. So you can put many names to it: totalitarianism, democracy in progress, or some kind of thing. But I'm going to go on. Fellini, I'm about to say Fellini. Mussolini's definition of fascism. And I also want to give a nod to Wolin, because this book is just super thought-provoking, I think, in general, but specifically for me as a writer, because I'm working on a new book, an introduction, since the bulk of the book, the essays and poems, have already been published online at Axis of Logic. I'm writing a an introduction, which I want to just be super sort of sum things up and be as concise as possible. So it's I'm going over and over and over and over it and reading other things, and this Wolin's book, because it touches on the totalitarianism and that the whole topic of the United States Empire, that it's a huge help to my writings and just to my general understanding. And as a little plug, my book is going to be called Drive Through Theo-Fascism and the Hero's Journey. So that gets explained later on. Now, Wolin's book, I had heard Chris Hedges, a fabulous journalist, author, activist, praising Wolin's book over and over and over again, and the topic itself was of interest to me. And just a few preliminary notes. The book I find in general fascinating because it speaks to better understanding the sort of illusionary, or the way that I guess maybe the Buddhists would call it the Mahamaya, the great illusion, the deception of the reality that in many ways the system that we live in, sort of the freedom of choice, sense of freedom of choice in a kind of Coke, Pepsi, Democrat, Republican way. But really, when you look behind the curtain, the system is rigged. In the preface, he mentions talking about the tendencies of the system, I believe totalizing in the sense that they are obsessed with control, expansion, superiority, and supremacy. This fits my label, supremacist control freaks, or what the Lakota would call the fat takers. And again, in the preface, he gives perhaps one of the tidiest summaries of inverted totalitarianism. Primarily, it represents the political coming of age of corporate power and the political demobilization of the citizenry. Coming of age of corporate power, political coming of age of corporate power, and the political demobilization of the citizenry. So essentially, it's like this corporate has taken over, and the politics is subservient in the political arenas, and also in the sense of demobilizing the populace and divisiveness that is instilled in the populace, where the populace can be arguing over who's going to be elected, Republican or Democrat, or should there be gay rights or not. And obviously some of these things are valid, but the point is that it steers the discussions to things that don't essentially change the overall system and divide the people, rather than you know, unifying them. And another factor he make, a point he makes in comparison to the 20th century totalitarian regimes, specifically he mentions Nazi Germany, Stalinist Russia, and Italy, that those were more overt and more politically, you know, impetus and sort of the going out and forcing people to change type of thing. Whereas he's saying that in this inverted totalitarianism, it's much more subtle, that people don't realize the lifestyle they're living, or that they're feeding the problem in a certain way. So that's what I find perhaps the most, one of the most fascinating cultural, political things expressed in the book, is he really breaks down the system both blatantly and subtly, and towards the end gives a few pointers at suggestions. It's not huge on how to solve the problem, but again, by just unraveling the problem, it certainly opens up one's thinking and allows one to sort of begin to free oneself from the system in further ways. And if there's anything omitted from the book, I would say it is the native people's already existent history and, you know, their lifestyle, democratic model that is their lifestyle. Save that for further on. And another bit on inverted totalitarianism. I tried to find a name for a new type of political system, seemingly one driven by abstract totalizing powers, not by personal rule, one that succeeds by encouraging political disengagement rather than mass mobilization, that relies more on private media than on public agencies to disseminate propaganda, reinforcing the official version of events. So that's a key factor there. You don't have some, like the crazed speeches we see of Hitler and everybody's clapping, and so the message gets out there. He's talking about this inverted totalitarianism where the media in many ways is the mouthpiece. That was the drumming, the war drumming before going to Iraq. I see it now with the whole Black Lives Matter and NYPD, where the media is, the media is sort of driving the message, and that's just nothing new. And here he references the most powerful 20th century dictatorships were highly personal. Here he gives some more of the past. In classic totalitarianism, the conquest of total power did not result from a coalescence of unintended consequences. It was the conscious aim of those who led a political movement. The most powerful 20th century dictatorships were highly personal, not only in the sense that each had a dominant, larger-than-life leader, but each system was peculiarly the creation of a leader who was a self-made man. Mussolini, Stalin, and Hitler did not just invent their personae. They literally built the organizations of their respective dictatorships. Each system was inseparable from its Führer or Duce. Inverted totalitarianism follows an entirely different course. The leader is not the architect of the system, but its product. George W. Bush no more created inverted totalitarianism than he piloted a plane onto the USS Abraham Lincoln. He is the pliant, favored child of privilege, of corporate connections, a construct of public relations wizards, and of party propagandists. The classic totalitarian regime, Stalin's Russia, Mussolini's Italy, and Hitler's Germany, were importantly the creation of a charismatic leader and unimaginable without his imprint. Inverted totalitarianism, on the other hand, is largely independent of any particular leader and requires no personal charisma to survive. Its model is the corporate head, the corporation's public representative. Among the classical dictatorships, only Stalin died while still in power, although his dictatorship did not survive the century. In the inverted system, the leader is a product of the system, not its architect. It will survive him. So yeah, you can see that with advertising, you know, it's almost like the fervor of advertising and the loud frenzied voices. This is just coming to mind now, the people cheering like crazy. I'm not making a direct comparison, but the way a lot of the TV shows, Oprah gives out, everybody gets gifts, and people go nuts on game shows. When they win a car, it's like the people go nuts, and it's like this fervor that is the sort of subtle beholden to the system, and that's where sort of people's enthusiasm is, in a way that they cheered, you know, they cheered for Hitler. Again, I'm not saying it's the same thing. It just comes to mind as this image of when Roland is talking about the sort of fervor and the charisma. And now we have a system where basically you watch news and leaders, and they're just almost always unemotional, tight-lipped, just sort of drone, robotic drone. But meanwhile, their actions are, you know, the violent anger that is expressed through their actions in wars. And so it's an interesting dynamic. And again, he's saying that the inverted totalitarianism, economics dominates politics. So it's, you know, it's a blend, but he's talking about what dominates, whereas the classic, the politics and the charisma figure dominated. Now it's the economics, and that is the basic system. And that gets into the whole, you know, corporate economic system, which is, as the book shows, one of the, I would say, theses of the book is, it's sort of under this, I call it a dualistic mindfuck. It's under this guise of democracy, nationalism, patriotism. Those are the key words where the public's furor is stirred. As now Sheldon is one of I really applaud him for. He's one of the most compassionate people I've read to mention. You know, the atrocity and the lies that led to Iraq and the loss of lives. So the stirring of the mindfuck is the dualistic mindfuck is this stirring of emotion to cause these actions that usually lead to, you know, a war or some major political decision, but the actual democracy part, the people have little say. And you know, the corporate lobbyists, etc., rule. So it's this definite sort of hypocrisy, duality thing going on. And here he begins a chapter, the utopian theory of superpower. Superpower is neat. He refers to the sort of concept, the way generations now have grown up on superheroes and cartoons, and that America sort of poses as a superpower. I mean, that's the phrase they use, superpower. And it sort of satisfies some juvenile level of the people, I guess, or at least to them. The superpower is not just a system of aggrandizing power, but an attempt at reconstituting the nation's identity. A compact statement of the ideology of superpower was set out in the National Security Strategy of the United States of September 9, 2002, hereafter NSS. It represented the clearest formulation of the administration's understanding of the mission of superpower and of its totalizing reach. The document is also the best evidence of the ideology promoting inverted totalitarianism. So he goes on to reference that, the National Security Strategy. You know, he's going right to the documents and to say where it's like the PNAC, the people, the New American Century, whatever that stands for. It's like some of these things are laid out in documents. So it's not just theorizing. He references someone in the Bush administration. There's a quote, pretty astounding quote, where they're talking about, you know, we make up the reality. Reality is ever changing, and we're ahead of the curve, and we make up the reality, and we make the decisions, and it comes across as this, like, really deluded Shakespearean character who is not dealing with reality, but is claiming to rule reality. And another thing that I again applaud Wolin to highlight, which for a while has been one of my things that I think just a lot of people miss, is that it's a flavor of the inverted totalitarianism, is that and I don't know the history, the classics that well, but in the inverted totalitarianism, it's like the homeland is seen as, you know, safe and cozy, but the wars are promoted, you know, elsewhere. Or that people, the people of the country don't realize what is going on elsewhere because it's not against them to that degree. So maybe his the passage here better explains it. The virtual reality of the advertiser and the good news of the evangelist complement each other, a match made in heaven. Their zeal to transcend the ordinary and their bottomless optimism both feeds the hubris of superpower. Each colludes with the other. The evangelist looks forward to the last days while the corporate executive systematically exhausts the world's scarce resources. Virtual reality has about it the character of unreality, of transcending the ordinary world and its common smells and sights. Its limiting rhythms of birth, growth, decline, death, and renewal. For Americans, the chosen people of advertising, technology, capitalist orthodoxy, and religious faith, the greatest triumph of virtual reality is war, the great unexperienced reality. Ever since the Civil War, Americans have fought wars at a distance. In Cuba, the Philippines, France, on almost every other continent in World War II, then in Korea, Vietnam, the Middle East. War is an action game played in the living room or a spectacle on a screen, but in either case not actually experienced. Ordinary life goes on uninterruptedly. Work, creation, professional sports, family vacations. After 9/11, terrorism becomes another virtual reality, experienced only through its recreated images, its destructiveness, wonders, absorbed through the spectacle of the occasional and hapless terrorist or captive journalist put on public display. In contrast, official policy decrees that the coffins of dead soldiers are not to be seen by the public. So it's very sanitized. I'm thinking of either The Daily Show or The Colbert Report doing a bit on whatever, how many lives were lost in a year about, people, choking on peanuts or something, and the number was far outweighs the terrorism, but yet, we have this whole system built on, protecting, defending from terrorism, which at some level presumably does some, protective stuff, but to just show the extremeness of it, it's like if every day we were being warned about not choking on peanuts, the ludicrousness of it would be apparent. Other flavors of the system he highlights is capitalism, technology, and science furnishing the sources of power. We see that with the military and people sort of wrapped up. I think one of Teokas and Ghost Horse's songs, the lyrics, the poem, it's like spoken word, has a line, something about if we can see where the sanctimonious technology is taking us. It's sort of this obeisance to the technology and the latest invention, the latest gadget, again at the expense of what is going on with the Mother Earth, and the use of this technology in a military sense is frightening. And again, with inverted totalitarianism, he refers to the Constitution. The two constitutions, one for expansion, the other for containment, form the two sides of inverted totalitarianism. Expansion and containment. So it's the ever increasing power, superpower, and global policeman. The containment is more, he cites environmental activists, trying to stop something that tends to get contained when they use the constitutional authority powers. Try to put into action what the Constitution represents, but then otherwise the Constitution sort of, however much used for expansion. And some other bits. Inverted totalitarianism, in contrast, appears as anti-collectivist. It idealizes individualism and adulates celebrities. And another bit. Inverted totalitarianism follows a different route. Instead of pursuing unanimity, it encourages divisiveness. Instead of rule by a single master race, it promotes predomination, that is, rule by diverse powers which have found it in their interest to combine while retaining their separate identities. The key components are corporate capital, the very rich, small business associations, large media organizations, evangelical Protestant leaders, and the Catholic hierarchy. And that gets into the title of my book, having to do with theofascism, how it connects with the religiosity of the times. So I'll repeat that. Key components are corporate capital, the very rich, small business associations, large media organizations, evangelical Protestant leaders, and the Catholic hierarchy. And again, he says, classic totalitarianism mobilized its subjects. Inverted totalitarianism fragments them. In place of the citizen participant, the new politics courts the viewer consumer. So that's part of the fragmentation of the media. Or, you know, you notice with the interview people on TV when they're, who are you voting for, even if it's local, and, you know, the teacher is going to vote for someone who's saying something, trying to help teachers, and the you know, another person is going to vote, a minority is going to vote for what's helping them, and the rich person is going to vote for the tax break. And so it's like this fragmented thing where we have our individual bennies, and the system becomes broken down that way rather than a sense of unified purpose. So I'm already seeing this barely getting through the inverted totalitarian references for the first show here. Trying to zip along, it's hard for me not to make too many comments. Unlike classical totalitarianism, which boasted of the unanimity of its citizens, inverted totalitarianism thrives on ambivalence and the uncertainty it breeds. And again, unlike Hitler, Mussolini, and Stalin, who set out consciously to establish one-party dictatorships to extend their rule beyond their nation's original borders, Lebensraum Mare Nostrum, World Revolution, I think the L-E-B-E-N-S-R-A-U-M, something about open space or more space. Inverted totalitarianism comes into being not by design, but by inattention to the consequences of actions, or especially of inactions, or more precisely, inattention to their cumulative consequences. So he goes on to explain it. It's kind of like it creeps up on people. You know, the way the media started in the 30s or 40s with the Bernays and public relations. So it's sort of this ongoing progression rather than a specific cited moment. An inverted totalitarian regime, precisely because of the inverted character, emerges not as an abrupt regime change or dramatic rupture, but as evolutionary, as evolving out of a continuing and increasingly unequal struggle between an unrealized democracy and an anti-democracy that dare not speak its name. Consequently, while we recognize familiar elements of the system, popular elections, free political parties, the three branches of government, a Bill of Rights, if we re-recognize invert, we see its actual operations as different from its formal structure. Its elements have antecedents but no precedents, a confluence of tendencies and pragmatic choices made with scant concern for long-term consequences. And more specifics, he highlights anti-democracy, executive predominance, and elite rule are basic elements of inverted totalitarianism. Anti-democracy does not take the form of overt attacks upon the idea of government by the people. Instead, politically, it means encouraging what I have earlier dubbed civic demobilization, conditioning an electorate to being aroused for a brief spell, controlling its attention span, and then encouraging distraction or apathy. The intense pace of work and the extended workday combined with job insecurity is a formula for political demobilization, for privatizing the citizenry. It works indirectly. Citizens are encouraged to distrust their government and politicians, to concentrate upon their own interests, to begrudge their taxes, and to exchange active involvement for symbolic gratifications of patriotism, collective self-righteousness, and military prowess. Above all, depoliticization is promoted through societies being enveloped in an atmosphere of collective fear and of individual powerlessness. Fear of terrorists, loss of jobs, the uncertainties of pension plans, soaring health costs, and rising educational expenses. Unlike the Nazis, who made life uncertain for the wealthy and privileged while providing social programs for the working class and poor, inverted totalitarianism exploits the poor, reducing or weakening health programs and social services, regimenting mass education for an insecure workforce threatened by the importance of low-wage workers. Employment in a high-tech, volatile, and globalized economy is normally as precarious as during an old-fashioned depression. The result is that citizenship, or what remains of it, is practiced amidst a continuing state of worry. Hobbes had it right. When citizens are insecure and at the same time driven by competitive aspirations, they yearn for political stability rather than civic engagement, protection rather than political involvement. Very insightful there. Basically, I think he's saying, you know, the fear, when the fear card is played, the masses look for, you know, like he says, political stability rather than civic engagement. Although, you know, that's debatable. And to be on the optimistic side, there is a lot of protests and people waking up now. And it goes backwards in time to show sort of the evolution of the process. And says at first democracy and capitalism were occasional political allies pitted against the stratified order of the monarchy, aristocracy, and established church. So going back in history, some of the origins of democracy and capital had like a positive side in a way, dethroning the ancient control systems of monarchy, aristocracy, and established church, as much of, you know, Thomas Paine's writings highlighted that, and why he was sort of left out, well, not sort of left out of the whole founding fathers bent, but that then eventually democracy and capitalism, you know, fast forwarding, started to work together in collusion and you know, create a different kind of power structure. And he cites the Reagan era marked the beginning of a new conception of the presidency, one that reinforced the 20th century tendency toward presidential domination of the political system. It was symbolic that Reagan attained the presidency by defeating the one president who had promised the American people that he would never lie to them. So that really gives the overview, the gist of the inverted totalitarianism, which is probably going to be enough for this one show. In essence, it looks like that'll be the part two. The managed democracy is in essence that, rather than what we think of democracy as the, you know, power of the people and the people having input and say, that the government, rather than encouraging that, it seeks to manage it. In a way that the Republicans and Democrats can face off, but I think it was Nader barely raised enough money or enough percentage to be in on the debate, so people get squelched out because they can't afford to play, and that is not democracy. That is not democracy. So in that sense, he shows how there's this, again, this concept of democracy and getting tidbits of it, but that in essence, the powers that be want to manage the democracy, not only locally, but, you know, as an empire, spreading it, you know, bringing democracy to other countries. Well, how is it brought to other countries when, you know, the elections are decided by the Supreme Court? So, you know, Wolin is very hip to the current recent history and touches on a lot of ancient history going back to the Greeks and forward, but again, the gist I would say of the to explain the title and the subtitle, Managed Democracy and the Specter of Inverted Totalitarianism, is that, you know, the managed democracy is like a corporate sort of military corporate technocratic rule that has its purpose to manage the people and to keep the people at bay, and thus the all that works in combination with the inverted totalitarianism, rather than the more overt and sort of more overtly horrific that were historically in the 20th century. And so that's it for part one of Democracy Incorporated, the book by Sheldon S. Wolin, published by Princeton, and plenty of stuff, food for thought, and much to chew on. So thanks for listening. Have a good one.
And we'll go out with a song by Bruce Colburn, but since not too long ago in a show played Call It Democracy, this time a live performance song called Pacing the Cage. Bloody sword.
Pacing the cage.